Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview recorded on the 20th of September 2021. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Christopher Mills, CEO at Harwood Capital, home of the North Atlantic Smaller Companies Investment Trust, the Oryx International Growth Fund, and involved in the joint venture with the Odyssean Investment Trusts, as well as other investment vehicles. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell us how
you
got involved in a career in investing and how Harwood Capital came about?
Well, basically, when I was at school, one of my friends started a thing called the Keynes Society, which was a society to understand about economics. And as part of that, we were all given the opportunity to put a small amount of money into a fund, which I duly did. Went on holiday for Christmas and came back and had trebled my money because it had all been invested in Australian nickel shares and Tasmanex in particular. And I thought, if it's this easy, this is something I really need to learn about.
And was it that easy going on from there?
Well, obviously not. Harwood Capital is a sort of a bit of a history. I started my career at Samuel Montague, which I actually joined them in 1971, but I was sent off to a university for 4 years. So I actually joined in 1975 in the investment division. Then in about 1982, I was going to leave to be a managing director of a company called Investcorp. And to get me to stay, they gave me one of their funds, which is now North Atlantic Smaller Companies Trust, which I managed since 1982. Then I stayed there for a bit, helped the business spun out Samuel Montague, became MIM and then Invesco MIM. And then I found and acquired Invesco for them, which turned out to be quite a good deal for them. And as you know, Invesco is now one of the largest fund manager companies in the world.
Absolutely.
And then in 1993, I left and was the founder with Jamie Hambrough of J.O. Hambrough Capital Management. And we built that business up from effectively very little to a substantial fund management business, very much assisted at the beginning by Nicola Pease, but much of the real growth at the end was done with the support of Gavin Rochesson. And in 2011, we sold the unit trust business. I bought out all the other shareholders, and we've now built Harwood Capital Management to about 2.3 billion today. Might be down a bit wee today, given where the markets are. And along the way of that, we built another business up effectively from scratch called Harwood Wealth that got floated, built that up to about 5 billion. And we sold that to Carlyle last year for about £100 million in March.
Amazing track record. So when you look to invest in a company, what are you looking for and has that changed over time and does it differ across the funds?
I suppose at the heart of things, we are value investors. You know, I think we're going to talk a few companies at some stage and you'll see that they all have strong balance sheets. We do some more adventurous investing, but that tends to be a much smaller proportion of our funds.
And beyond that, what are you looking for?
Basically, if you're a value investor, you're looking for companies that you believe are trading at discounts to private market value. But the key to it is to make sure you don't walk into value traps. And therefore, you have to take, or we do take, a somewhat activist approach where you'll see us sit on the boards or have representatives on boards of many of the companies that we invest in so that we believe the management is aligned with the shareholders to build shareholder value. In some cases, we hold the investments for very long periods of time, hopefully making sure they don't become lifestyle businesses.
But it can be hard work getting involved in the companies. How do you make sure that your time is used judiciously so it doesn't sort of just use up all your time and you don't derive the value from it?
Well, I suppose the key to everything in life is ultimately, hopefully, choosing a good business and then making sure you have a good management team in place. So, you know, if you have something that's working really well and really easy, then frankly, it's not a lot of work. It's the ones where things start to go wrong, or obviously from time to time, they'll require more work and effort because they've got to make an acquisition or a disposal or whatever. So it's very much, I suppose, a private equity approach to public company investing. But of course, we have here a private equity business as well, which mercifully has been actually very successful for us over the years.
And you've got strong exposure to life sciences. What is it about life sciences that excites you?
Well, I suppose we've been in life sciences for a long period of time. We've never really done drug development. So we're really into a bit of components, but a lot of it is diagnostics or specialist services. Basically, these are fundamentally good businesses. For a long period, they were, in my opinion, significantly undervalued, and that's beginning to change. And you've seen big increases in life science company valuations all over the world. But basically, you have the opportunity to get into these businesses with good market. You know, often these businesses have good market shares and niches. And I'll give you some examples of some early companies that we did. And basically, they throw up lots of cash, enables you to grow the business, and they're fundamentally growing businesses. So an easy example for you would be that a long time ago, we owned a company called Orthoplastics. Orthoplastics was a duopoly providing very complex plastics, hips and knees. When we invested in the company, nobody really cared. I think we paid 5 or 6 times to get into it. Everybody who likes running marathons on roads is a natural customer because their knees will run out and their hips won't be in good shape either. But basically, it's a simple play on people getting older with more and more people needing hips and knee surgery. So you had a market growing sort of 3% per annum in real terms. We took the opportunity while we owned the business to move just out from making plastics into making components. The barriers to entry are prohibitive. You could not get into that business in 5 years if you wanted to. So it had good margins, growing business, an opportunity to add on to that. Another business we did a long time ago would have been Celsius. Celsius was a conglomerate. We sold the bits and pieces off, and we focused on the core business, which was detecting the rapid detection of pathogens in liquids. So that fitted in with just-in-time manufacturing. It was, when we got involved in the business, it was really a European-American business. By the time we finished, it was a global business. So there's a whole bunch of stories around that, and they've been successful investments for us. We think we know what we're doing and have done very, very well in it.
So, of course, what we all want to know is what provides the best opportunities in the sector today?
Well, the one that we really like and we're still buying at the moment, and I just think it's frankly a no-brainer as an investment, is Circassia. To give you some background, the management team, we were involved in the largest shell in a company called Bioquell, which we sold to Ecolabs about 3 years ago now. The management team went in there, they cleaned up the business. I think they went in the share price of £1.40, and 3 years later they got us out at nearly £6. The same team, Ian Johnson was executive chairman at Bioquell, Michael Roller was finance director at Circassia. And now it's Circassia, and Circassia has now been cleaned up. It was a total mess that came out of the Woodford stable. But they just came out with results where they announced that they are now EBITDA positive, and they believe there's significant opportunities from here. To put it in context, the management has a super bonus at 62.4p a share, which would value the company at about 250 million. And that compares to the current share price of 37p. So, you know, how real is it that you can get the share price to at least 62.5p? The only business left in the company is Niox, which is a point-of-care test for nitrogen so that asthmatics can determine how much nitrogen they have in their breath, which enables them to control which medicine that they use. The company has a totally dominant market share, and to put it in its context, it's got about 90% recurring revenues, 75% EBITDA margins, and they have no debt and about 11, 12 million of cash at the moment. Now, because the business basically requires people to go into hospitals and or doctors, the business was hurt last year but it's now recovering strongly, and brokers forecasts of around about 27 million of sales this year, with EBITDA in the region of 2 million. We expect sales to grow to approximately 40 million over the next couple of years as things get back to normal. And to put that in context, actually sales in 2019 were 35 million. So it's not such a big hop to get up to 40 million. And when they get there, we would be looking at give or take 11 million pounds of EBITDA. And obviously there's a high probability this company is going to get sold at some stage. So the buyer would look at another couple of million of add back in corporate overhead. So you're looking basically at 13 million of EBITDA. A company with this sort of market share, this sort of growth, is certainly worth 15 times EBITDA, which is sort of 195 million. We would expect the cash, and they've also successfully negotiated a payment for a product. So the cash should be up to about 35 million if all goes according to plan. And then because of the unfortunate mistakes of the past, the company has a 600 million pound tax loss carry forward. That would save the buyer probably 150 million in taxes, but it would take time to arrive. So if you did a present value of that, say 20 million pounds, you've got your 250 million pounds, easy peasy. I'm making the assumption the buyer will have a global distribution network, and that would enable them to cut out costs in the sales expense of about 6 million. The buyer would have a much larger global presence. Although this company is totally dominant in its marketplace, it still only has 5% of the world market. So a buyer with that sort of opportunity could well start paying A for the synergies and B for the ultimate market growth, not so dissimilar to the price that we got for Bioquell. That's just the core business. The company is also now developing plans to enter the home care market, basically move out of hospitals and doctors' offices into other healthcare facilities and or homes. And should that prove successful, that too would have a major impact on the company's business. As I said, the results came out recently. They were materially higher than market expectations. And to give anybody listening to this some comfort, all the senior executive directors bought shares around about the current market price on Thursday.
Tremendous. Thank you very much indeed. Do you want to say anything about Source Bio that gave an update today?
Yes. I mean, the Source Bioscience has, I suppose, if you look at it, three assets. First of all, it's got a market cap today of 90 million. So basically, it's got about 20 million pounds in cash. It's got about circa 10 million tied up in working capital in COVID testing, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And thirdly, it's got its core business, which is a mixture of genomics, which grew very rapidly even in 2020, pathology, which had a terrible year in 2020 because people weren't doing cancer testing, which is tragic because if you don't do the cancer testing, things are a lot worse when you finally get around to it. And then a stability storage business where it's a global leader. The company's announced that they're already back on track on the pathology business. And the pathology business is a naturally good growth industry because the NHS is increasingly having to outsource pathology because takes about 10 years to be a fully trained pathologist, and something like 25% of their pathologists are due to retire in the next 7 to 10 years. Also, this company specializes in doing very complex testing. So to give you some concept of that, each test will consume something like 5 gigabits of data, and it then takes very experienced people to read that data. Because if you get this wrong, you really can kill people. Obviously you don't, but the failure to diagnose the cancer appropriately would have very bad effects for people. So that's fundamentally a good business. And we think that those three businesses are worth being at 70 million pounds, perhaps a wee bit more, if they were to be sold to a third party, because they're growing collectively at about 15 to 20% with EBITDA in there, excluding corporate overhead, of in excess of £5 million. So COVID testing. Company has announced it does about 15,000 COVID tests a day, and it was hoping to build that up to about 30,000, well, 22,000 in its own facilities and another few thousands outside there. Clearly, with the government's announcement today, that will stop within the next, say, 4 or 5 weeks. Although COVID PCR testing is what we're discussing, will continue on because as you go to other countries, they still require you to do a PCR test when you enter them. So it's unquestionably going to slow. The other side of it is that there's a number of laboratories out there that don't have full approvals. What they've been doing is saying they're going to get approvals. They then don't get approvals. They close themselves down and start up again the next day. And the government is cracking down on that. So if COVID testing was to, let's say, stabilize around about 5,000 tests a day, there is also pricing pressure. This would still be a nicely profitable COVID testing business, but certainly not of the order of market forecasts for this company, which I think were, you know, £30 million-£35 million. That's the thing of the past.
So you think the drop in the share price today is understandable?
I think at the current level, the company stacks up on fundamentals. Because if you just simply say COVID testing was to stop tomorrow, everyone would pay us. We'd work off the bit of inventory we've got, and it's not big. You'd have a business, you know, with £30 million of cash and a nice, rapidly growing core business.
Thank you. And are there any others in the sector that you think we should be looking at?
I think the days of Clinigen will be numbered. Elliott's got a big stake in it. I think Clinigen itself is a bit of a mess, to be truthful with you, but I'm sure it can be sorted out.
What do you think should happen there?
Well, what I think should happen is kind of irrelevant because I'm not the one on the board, but somebody needs to basically start integrating all those businesses. It's never really happened, in my opinion. The strategy that they've employed in the past of, well, because we sold a business called Quantum Pharma, which we got involved in. We cleaned it up. I think we raised the money at 35p and they paid us 95p in about 18 months later. So we got some insight into how they ran businesses at the time. And, you know, it was from an outsider's perspective, what they were trying to do was buy earnings using their high multiple. Now, that clearly doesn't, that's still not, that's not going to be an option anymore. But I think there's probably some value in Clinigen, but I think it'll take a bit of time to come out. But I don't see Elliott going away. It's not their reputation.
Thank you. And what sectors beyond life sciences do you think provide the most interesting investment opportunities today?
Well, we've got a couple of quite large investments in fund management businesses. One of them is Polar Capital. And Polar Capital, for us, is a relatively simple story. Again, it's on a P you can recognize, like about 12.5. It's got no debt, about £100 million in cash, yielding nearly 5%. The logic behind Polar Capital is we're not very good at technology, where P's are often infinity and yields are zero. So Polar provides an ideal solution as 50% of their funds are tech, while the balance of their other assets are growing very fast. As the company's chief executive, Gavin Rochussen, who obviously I worked with at J O Hambro Capital Management, takes the company into ESG and emerging markets. So I kind of think for us, that's a very easy no-brainer because I absolutely believe Gavin to build this business very significantly over the next 3 to 5 years.
And you don't worry about increasing compliance costs or increasing demands from fund managers to earn more?
I think fund managers, they have an interesting model where the fund managers actually have their own business. That's what kind of caps it. So the terms are set out. It's not a wage thing. You own part of your business, and then ultimately you can switch that into Polar Capital shares. So it's the same model basically as we had at J O Hambro Capital Management. So basically, it ties the fund manager to the performance, to his own performance. So it's a bit difficult for him to start arguing for more money. Compliance costs are there, but once you reach a certain size, they become more containable, I suppose.
Great.
But yes, it's a problem for the whole industry. I mean, we are a large shareholder in Polar. I think we're the second largest institutional shareholder. The second one that we have a big stake in is obviously ASSETCo.
Yes.
Where we are the largest shareholder, and we are backing Martin Gilbert, who built Aberdeen to create a new fund management business. Certainly the transactions he's done to date have been, in my opinion, outstandingly good. And we look forward to working with him to build it still further.
How long has he been there?
Since the beginning of the year.
And what's he done in that time?
Well, we've basically done, I suppose, four transactions. One was a small fund management business to basically give us all the regulatory approvals, but they have some excellent performance. The next is a platform business, which we bought 30% of. And that was a platform business that was bought out of Aberdeen, which, in my opinion, it was bought at a very favorable price. And then we basically have done another platform deal for launching ETFs. And then finally, of course, we have a stake in River and Mercantile, which has announced it's selling off its trust business, and I think will be a successful investment for us. Certainly, it's going well so far.
So where do you see it going from here?
Let's put it this way. I'm on the board. I know. I can't tell you.
Moving on to what you wanted to move on to.
And then the third one, where, again, we're the largest shareholder, is Frenkel Topping. And Frenkel Topping, we believe, is performed well, and it just came out with results today that were very good indeed. But we think we're just at the start of the journey at Frenkel Topping. Frenkel Topping still only has a market capitalization of about 75 million. And basically, it's an IFA, but this is not the traditional IFA story, which we think increasingly doesn't work anymore, because what we did in Harbour Capital was we basically bought IFAs, consolidated them, but the key was there was an arbitrage spread between the value of our equity and the price we could buy these businesses at. Now that is changing. The price of businesses is going up, so it's getting much more competitive. You know, obviously we sold to Carlyle, so they're now in the marketplace looking to buy. And there's also a risk that this industry becomes a target for defined benefit mis-selling. So if we talk about Frenkel Topping, the results that came out today, our EBITDA went up by about 120%. The reason why Frenkel Topping is interesting is that it's one of the few IFAs that can actually grow its funds under management organically. And the reason for that is that we're in a niche part of the market, which is the court settlements business. Now, the court settlements business basically generates about 4 billion of funds under management a year. And those funds are to look after people who have been very severely damaged, either through clinical negligence or through catastrophic accidents, such as falling off the back of a motorcycle, and you're going to be a vegetable for most of the rest of your life. So you have to have a very conservative investment policy, and it's therefore a specialist business. Frenkel Topping has about 4% of that marketplace at the moment, which means that we're actually growing the funds under management at about 15%+ a year, which no IFA even gets close to.
Absolutely.
And so that is a really nice business. We might have to buy at some stage a small IFA just to cope with the volume, but we're categorically not going to be an IFA consolidator. Then if you look behind that business, there's a 2.5 billion service business looking after the people to help them after their severe injury, get them their compensation claims, etc. And that's split about 1.5 billion in legal and 1 billion in various services. And the various services businesses, basically relatively small businesses, it's a fragmented industry, and Frankel Topping is the sort of first company, or absolutely got first mover advantage in basically consolidating that service industry. And these are nice little companies. They've been built up by individuals, many of which are reaching retirement age, but who are prepared to do earnouts and stay for at least 2 to 3 years after we acquire the business and consolidate it into our group. At the moment, we believe Frankel Topping is the largest writer of witness reports. So basically, when this person, this damaged person, goes up just towards the end of getting their compensation, we need to say to the judge who's going to give the award, you know, this person, if he needs prosthetics, will need to change his prosthetics, say, another 7 times in his life. At the cost of prosthetics, he will need this. He will likely need the nursing care at some stage in his or her life. And on it goes. And this isn't ambulance chasing at all. This is basically a professional report that's accepted by both sides. This is what this person is going to need. And that will be gathered also from other service providers. The second thing, which we're now the largest in the United Kingdom in, is costing services. So what costing services are is all to do with the person has just had his accident. Let's say he's lost his legs in the accident. So it'll take about 2 to 3 years to go through the court process. So what does it cost to keep this person financially sound, et cetera, for the 2 to 3 years while it goes through the court process? And, you know, that requires, you know, does he need psychiatric help? Again, in this case, prosthetics. Does he need a new car because he can't touch the pedals of his own car? Is the staircase too steep in his home, so he's going to have to move home? And on it goes. Does he need physiotherapy, psychology? And basically, a costings company will take that to the court. The court will agree what's fair and reasonable to look after him over that 2 to 3 year period. It has nothing to do with his final settlement. It's just to keep him going for that period. And our last acquisition, for example, we bought the leading company in the United Kingdom dealing with cerebral palsy, for example. And the long-term thinking behind all of this is that as we grow the businesses and as we grow the services, that will give us hopefully two competitive advantages. One, we can go to the lawyers and say, we can provide this suite of services for you, which makes it easier for them to go to a one-stop shop. And we can be more competitive on pricing because we will have the whole suite of services. The second aspect is it'll give us more entry points into the client with the long-term objective of increasing our funds under management market share.
And how long have you been involved with it? Because historically, it was the business model's the same, but it was a fairly torrid journey for investors.
Well, we became involved in it, I would say, 2 years ago, but I really went on the board about a year ago now. The new strategy was very much a function of something that was dreamt up by Richard Fraser and I, because I obviously had the experience of being involved in building an IFA. You know, their previous strategy was to clean it up and sell it to somebody, but that didn't work. Then they were thinking of building an IFA group, and I basically said that doesn't make any sense. And then Richard knows all these other service providers because it's a small industry, they're all friends, and basically has unrivaled contacts with these companies. That's the strategy we agreed to do. We raised the money to do it. We've still got no debt and about 6-7 million in cash. So we continue on with our acquisition program. There'll be some earnout payments, but they aren't very large at the moment. So just, I suppose, everything came together at the right time. One of the things that we look for and is, you know, really sticky money where there isn't fee compression. And this fits the bill as good as it gets.
And moving on, you've got a fantastic track record with successes like MJ Gleeson, EKF and Aegean. How do you find the right strategy and the right management? And how critical was your role in these turnarounds?
Well, obviously, I don't do the work. I don't do much of it anyway. So, I mean, if you just go through Gleeson, I mean, when we first got in Gleeson, we were interested in it because, frankly, it was trading at a discount to tangible book. It's obviously trading now at a substantial premium to tangible book. Strategic NAM is always fundamentally good business, but it's cyclical. And sadly, some of their heads of housing in the past had, let's say, not been as good as they should have been. And they'd overpaid for land and stuff like that. So I joined the board, and then a man called David Floyd introduced me to Johnny and Harrison. And basically the board met Johnny and Harrison, thought he was a really good guy, and Johnny and came in, completely transformed the housing business. And that's how that one got started. EKF was different. EKF, the board had had a strategy of making acquisitions, which led to a strategy of overpromising and under-delivering. And then they made a catastrophic acquisition called Sela, at which point they lost pretty well all credibility in the city. And at one stage, EKF stood for every known F-up. And basically, we got involved because we believe the fundamental value of the point-of-care business is worth more than the share price. There was an aggressive American who was basically trying to sack the management team. And we thought the management team were actually very good. We wanted to change the strategy. So we became the company's largest shareholder. The Americans threatened to sue the management team. So Harvard indemnified them from the lawsuit, which I think saw things that we can do, which other institutions wouldn't do. I then went on board as chairman. We then adopted a program, which they're all grateful doesn't happen anymore, where every single week we put a list of tasks that had to be done, and every single week we examined where we were in those tasks. All the board fees got cut to zero.
Gosh.
Interesting way to make our other directors happy, but never mind, it's appropriate. But a third of the workforce was ultimately removed, and a number of facilities were closed, and we just focused on restoring the business to health. Which it happened quite some time ago now. We basically said we're not going to do any more risky acquisitions, which we haven't done so far. We're not planning to do them anyway. And the real point to the whole story is that a core business that losing money over a three-year period with the management team that was in place turned that round to making 10-plus million a year.
Amazing.
That enabled to build a balance sheet, have lots of cash. We started paying dividends. And then, of course, pretty well all thanks to Julian Baines, we took one of our technologies and entered into a joint venture with Mount Sinai, which resulted in a whole string of, new life sciences companies being spun off into the public marketplace.
Which includes Trellis Health.
Greenalytics, Verici, Trellis, yes.
Yeah.
And so the people were already there. It's just, obviously they went along with the acquisition strategy, but it just wasn't the right thing for that company at the right time. The early acquisitions were fundamentally good, but then it was a rush to keep the share price up to make the next one. So we took a completely different line when I arrived, and that was that we wouldn't do profit warnings unless we really had to. And I think it's fair to say we've had at least 16 profit upgrades since I became chairman.
Yeah, it's been a phenomenal track record on that one. And looking at the recovery plays that you take on, these value investments, what success rate do you achieve? I mean, does it go wrong?
Well, I'll answer about Augean and then I'll talk about one that has gone wrong.
Okay.
It wasn't intended to be a recovery play, though. Augean basically had a chief executive who had made a number of mistakes and basically had to go, and I talked to a number of other shareholders and it was agreed that he should. And then at the same time, a huge claim arrived from the Inland Revenue, which scared a lot of people, even though the company said the claim was without merit, and that remains our opinion, it is without merit. And in fact, we're now suing the Inland Revenue.
Gosh.
Because we paid it off because it was just easier to pay it rather than incur the interest. Mm. And then I met Jim Meredith, who'd been chairman, but overseen this bit of a mess. And I realized here was the man who could solve all my problems. He knew exactly what to do to clean this company up. And he's done a stunningly good job. Mark, who's the finance director, has also done a stunningly good job. But, from the very beginning, Jim made it clear that you know, we're all going to work together, but we're all going to work together to deliver a victory for shareholders. We would probably have tried to do that last year, but COVID came along. And as you know, well, there's two bidders for the company at the moment. And the share price is up to sort of 340. Well, that's the last bid was 340. But no, I mean, that's very much down to Jim and his management team, who literally cut the cost base significantly, refocused the business on ash, where I think we're now the market leader in the disposal of hazardous ash. And we're going to hopefully give the shareholders something to smile about.
Well, you have done already, yes. So, going back to your success rate, how many hits do you get and how many misses, percentage-wise?
I mean, there have been mistakes, but the big recent mistake was Eskin.
Yeah.
Which was the Earl Stobart. I don't actually think, honestly, the investment decision was a mistake, because they came out after the COVID thing and told the world that they'd been extremely close to selling 25% of the airport for £175 million. Had they done that, the private market value would have been twice what we paid. Mm. Obviously, as COVID arrived, the airport effectively closed. Well, it hasn't closed because there is a logistics centre at the airport, which is actually nicely profitable, but it doesn't make the thing profitable. Then, of course, housing slowed down, which meant the amount of waste wood slowed down, so the amount of woods for wood chipping, which is their other business, slowed down, but that's now recovering. But it hasn't been a pretty story. Another mistake was girls' soccer, although that wasn't that expensive, where it was just fraud. And the question is, can we win some of that money back through litigation? And not sure I've got wish to do another litigious job. I've done too many in my life. So those would be examples of recent mistake. We were lucky because it didn't show, the Eskin error didn't really show in our asset value last year, because we had a private equity investment which had been in our books for a long period of time, which was into cybersecurity. And we were valuing it at $1.25, and we owned about 1.4 million shares. And we sold 1.2 million, an average of about $30.
So wow.
That covered the error, but that was more luck than good judgment.
And looking at both of them, looking back, could you have done anything to avoid it? I mean, with Eskin, black swan event of COVID.
Yeah, there was nothing we could do about that. The problem when you have fraud and the chief executive and chief financial officer are cooperating in it, and it was quite a sophisticated fraud, because they would create earnings by capitalizing fictitious capital expenditure, and the auditors pick it up. So it looked as if we had lots of free cash flow. It looked as if we were investing in the business and growing the business. But in reality, a lot of it resulted in balancing off. And then they got innovative with the VAT payments the company was paying. And the Inland Revenue visited the company more than three times to review our VAT. They didn't pick it up. The auditors didn't pick it up. And the fact the company had won a VAT tribunal case against the revenue led the board to conclude that the management knew what they were doing on VAT. Sadly, didn't turn out to be the case.
And do you think you're better now at assessing management and assessing people character, which is what it ultimately comes down to?
Oh, God. Well, let's go back. I would hope so, but I've been at this game for 45 years now. So if I haven't learned a bit along the way from that, then things really are a bit depressing.
And why is the discount to NAV so high for the North American smaller companies IT?
I think it's there's probably two problems. A, there are big holdings there, but they're companies that are not very well known by people. And so unless I'm sitting here and, let's say, telling you the story on Frenkel Topping, which would be a £20 million holding, you know, you could say, what on earth is that? And, remember when I first mentioned the name Frenkel Topping, you kind of were inferring it was a bit of a dog. Truthfully, it had passed. But if you don't know the stories behind it, if you don't do your research, you just need to know why we own these companies and how we're going to get in and out of them and what the plans are. There's a portfolio of private equity in there, which again, you know, people just think, what on earth is that? But you know, if I take you, for example, just give you a few ideas in the latest fund, CC is that we bought businesses at an average of about 5.5 times. It's growing very rapidly. It's pet food. HML is property services. We bought that at about 6.5 times. There's then a specialty packaging business for third largest medical packaging business in the United Kingdom. That was bought at about just under 7 times. And by the way, we don't put a lot of debt in these deals. Then there's a data center deal, which was bought at 8 times. We tried to buy another business, which was about the same size as us, and it was sold 15.5 times. So it's possible we're actually going to sell that business within a year of owning it. Another one, which I'm really excited about, is a company called 3BL. 3BL was bought at 6 times cash EBITDA. It's growing at 20% per annum, and it's the largest company in the world assisting, and it's not big, but it just happened to be the largest in the world, assisting very large corporations as to how they communicate their ESG strategies to stakeholders. So their clients would be Walmart, World Wildlife Fund, Bloomberg. They've literally got 40% of the S&P as clients. And they're now going down into Fortune 500 companies.
Very interesting sector.
So, you know, if you look at all those companies and say, you know, the average there was probably 7 times, you know, we would hope when we come to sell these companies and we build them up a bit, you know, we'll be looking at, you know, 10, 11 times and growing them. And a good example would be something we just sold, which is a joint venture with Lloyds Development Capital. We built up a very good pest control business. We provide products to professional pest control companies like Rentokil, Orkin, etc. We built that up over 4 or 5 years. We then put it into a vehicle called Pelsis, which was controlled by Lloyds, and about trebled our money when we did that. And then Pelsis itself performed reasonably well while we were together. So that company, by the time we came to sell it, was making about 30 million euros and got sold for about 10 times, a bit more than 10 times EBITDA. So resulting in another double, and that's sort of 20 million pounds is just hitting our balance sheet as we speak. But if you don't know what's in there, I think that's a problem. I think the second problem is a lot of the investors have been with me for a very, very long period of time. And when I started the fund in 1982, the NAV was 32p, and it might not be quite this today because the market's a bit rough, but last time I checked, it was about £64.
Phenomenal.
So, you know, people have made 200 times their money, and it's relatively tightly held. So we're a big company, but you know, it's not that easy to buy 10,000 shares.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that puts the big institutions off. So we have very little institutional ownership. The board, past and present, probably has over 40% of the company. And, you know, some people just like the fact that all the board are large shareholders. And the chairman in particular, I think, has got about £15 million in it. And by the way, we changed the board. I mean, we've got 3 directors who are all in there for less than 4 years. So that's not the issue. Chairman has been there for a long time. And we have hundreds, if not thousands, of relatively small investors. But as I said, it goes back to, you know, an average volume of 6,000 shares a day.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt you've had a phenomenally successful career. Is there anything that you haven't done that you wish you had, or anything you still aspire to do?
Gosh. No, I don't want to climb Everest. We can relax about that. But you know what? I have a very happy life. I actually enjoy my work enormously. I'm lucky enough that I don't have to work for a living. And I enjoy the challenge of analyzing a new company. It's like just learning a new subject all the time. You know, how does the company work? What makes it tick? Where's its cash flows? It's just like learning kind of a totally new subject every time. So you're creating knowledge. And I'm someone who also, if you ask me about my hobbies, I probably read 40 books a year. You wouldn't want to read many of them, but because it's mainly history. But you know, there's a thirst for knowledge. And as long as that thirst exists, I love what I do. You know, I ski, I shoot a bit, play bridge a bit, got a lovely family, so I'm really happy.
Tremendous. Thank you very, very much indeed. Can you tell people where they can find out more about you and the funds?
Well, one of the easy things, which I've always said to people, is, you know, if you want to, there's obviously our annual report, but as long as hundreds don't start calling me, just give me a call. I'll say two things. I'm more than happy to talk about it. I visit lots of people, you know, bringing them up to date more. Yes, we get a few new buyers from time to time, but as I said, it's hard for the institutions because the institution who are with me have been with me for a very, very long period of time. Occasionally we get a new one, but they just can't find stock. That's the problem. We do buy back stock as well, which doesn't possibly help. To give you an idea, there are exactly 14 million shares outstanding. If we hadn't bought back stock, there would be about 27 million shares outstanding.
Thank you so much, Christopher, for a great interview.
Well, thank you.
And to all our listeners, please write reviews, like and comment on our content on the different platforms. It means a lot to us and it helps us get the very best guests like Christopher. You can also click to subscribe at the top right-hand side of piworld.co.uk to get a notification of a new video as it's published with no spam. Many thanks for listening and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.